The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
He was not the top rung of the leadership of these chat groups that were focused on January 6th. And there wasn't as much about him or by him in the Telegram chats, but he took the stand. And then it turned out the government had found a video of him that looks for all the world like he's pepper spraying police officers. And he had said over and over and over that he never assaulted anybody. And after they showed him some of this footage, they said, "Now, after seeing this and having thought about it overnight, did you pepper spray police officers?" And he said, "I don't recall." So his testimony was pretty bad. I think it hurt him.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 5th, 2023. It is Proud Boys verdict day, mid-morning. The jury notified Judge Tim Kelly that it had reached a partial verdict, and that partial verdict was guilty of seditious conspiracy for four of the five defendants. A whole lot of stuff went down today, a big day for the Justice Department. There are really only two people who have end-to-end visibility on this trial who are not participants in it on one side or the other, and we are here with one of them before a live audience. Roger Parloff, who needs no introduction to the Lawfare audience, senior editor at Lawfare, longtime legal reporter, and the man who has live tweeted 61 days of the Proud Boys trial. Roger, how does it feel to have it all done?
It feels good. It was a bit grueling. It was very interesting. I'm sure the jurors feel that much more. But it was an amazing experience.
When we had you and Brandy Buckman on a few days ago, when this trial went to the jury, you were both, actually, I thought, a little bit concerned about the seditious conspiracy charge because of what you guys called the no plan issue. The jury got to guilty on that for four of the five of the defendants. So it's the lead charge. It was the one I think you were most worried about. So walk us through what happened here. Why do you think, first of all, to what extent was the defendant who was not convicted on that point differently situated from the others? And secondly, what did it take for the jury to get past the sticking points that you anticipated here?
Yeah, well, first, the easier question, which is a little speculative still, but why did they acquit Dominic Pezzola while convicting the other four defendants? And I think the likely reasons were the other four were all leaders in the Proud Boys. One was the leader, the chairman, Enrique Tarrio. The other was the ground leader that day, Ethan Nordine. And next was Joe Biggs, who might have been the most famous Proud Boy. And then there was Zach Reel, who was head of the Philadelphia Proud Boys. And they were all leaders of a chapter that Tarrio created on December 20th that was aimed at January 6th. It was this special chapter was created the day after Trump called for there to be a rally on January 6th in the famous Will Be Wild tweet. Pezzola was very different. He had only been a Proud Boy for about 2 months, if that, as of January 6th. So he was a new recruit. He had already distinguished himself in leadership's eyes, but he was not a leader. He wasn't in on any of the... So this special chapter was called MOSD, Ministry of Self-Defense. He wasn't in on any of those chats before January 2nd. He didn't really participate in them. There's no evidence that he did. And he really didn't know... He only knew Tarrio before the events. There were some of the defendants he had never spoken to or had contact to at all. So there were ways to distinguish him and to say, well, maybe he wasn't really a part of the conspiracy. He didn't know what was supposed to happen. So this was a logical distinction to draw. And so for two of the conspiracy counts, they acquitted him. And for one, they did convict. Now, I would have to interview them to understand what the distinction there was, to be honest. But for the first two, that made sense. He was convicted of the substantive account of obstructing an official proceeding because he did go into the Capitol. But the conspiracies he was not convicted of. I mean, the two of the three conspiracies he was not convicted of.
Yeah, so let's run down the basically the chart, and we actually put together a handy dandy chart of who was convicted of what and who was where the jury hung and where the jury is acquitted. What can we say? And I'm gonna see if through the magic of Zoom I can actually and YouTube I can actually put this up here. But walk us through what the jury did today.
Well, there were 46 counts. Everybody was charged with 45 of them, and then Pezzola was charged alone with robbery that had to do with his stealing a riot shield from a police officer in a very violent scuffle. So there were three conspiracy charges. And as you can see, the four defendants were convicted of all of the, those are counts 1, 2, and 4. Everybody but Pezzola was convicted on seditious conspiracy. Pezzola was acquitted. Everybody but Pezzola was convicted on conspiracy to obstruct of an official proceeding. That was a hung jury as to Pezzola. And then everyone was convicted on conspiracy to prevent officials from discharging their official duties.
So walk me through, if you were Merrick Garland, how, or if you were Jack Smith, or if you, I mean, Jack Smith, the special counsel, wasn't responsible for this case, but the U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, or if you were, you know, one of the people responsible for this investigation, how do you feel today? Is this just simply a big win, or are any of the charges that you lost particularly bothering you?
I think this is a huge, unambiguous win. All of the most important counts were convictions. Pezzola was acquitted of seditious conspiracy and not convicted on one of the two others, but he was convicted on other important felonies. And there is a logic to what the jury did. The fact that there is a logic to what they did sort of helps the government's chances of having these things be upheld on appeal. It looks like you didn't just have a jury that was angry and just went down the jury, the verdict form, and guilty, guilty, guilty. They were discerning. There are 10 counts where they were hung. There are 5 counts where they acquitted. So it looks like a discerning jury, which is what you like to be able to tell in appellate court. Incidentally, they were very careful, and in fact, they caught a typo in the jury verdict form before any of the lawyers or the judge did. So I think it's just pretty unalloyed good news for the government at this stage. The one count that they returned no verdict on was an assault charge that really was weak. It was an assault charge where a co-conspirator of theirs, alleged, named Charles Donahoe, threw water bottles at the police. But Donahoe was never called as a witness. So that's already a little weak. And then none of the defendants were in the immediate vicinity of Donahoe when he threw these things. So it was a pure theory of what's called co-conspirator liability. If you and Donahoe are both co-conspirators, and throwing water bottles was in furtherance of the conspiracy and, you know, reasonably foreseeable consequence of the conspiracy, you can hold them all responsible. They decided not to do that. And
it's kind of like the conspiracy version of felony murder if nobody died.
Yes. And on top of that, you know, throwing water bottles at the police, it can be a bad thing, but without the guy to testify and without somebody that was hit by them to testify, you really don't know what you're talking. Were they empty? Were they full? Were they frozen? So that was, and actually, 4 of the other charges that were hung related to the destruction of that window, the windows that everybody has seen Dominic Pozzola bust out with the stolen riot shield, a very important moment. But they were apparently reluctant to buy into the co-conspirator theory that, you know, Enrique Tarrio, who was in Baltimore at the time, you know, was responsible for Pozzola breaking out those windows. So, you know, you like to see a discerning jury, and that's what we seem to have had. I'm sure the defense lawyers don't exactly look at it that way, but I think that's an arguable way to look at it.
So I want to zoom out and look at this in the context of the 2 Oath Keepers verdicts, one of which involved a case you also covered wall to wall, and the 1,000 or so other cases that involve lower level folks, as well as the cases that haven't materialized, in parentheses, yet, against anybody in the political echelon. And I want to check in on our ongoing discussion about how the Justice Department is doing. It seems to me there's a kind of heck of a case at this point that, at least as to the actors on the ground on January 6th, they've amassed quite a record.
Yes, I think so. They've had more than 600 convictions already. They've charged, I think according to the GW University Program on Extremism, they've charged 999 federally. And that does not count some that have been charged in superior court. So it's just been a huge and very successful so far investigation. This is now, we now have 14 convictions for seditious conspiracy. That's 10 by juries and 4 by guilty plea. That's 9 Oath Keepers and 5 Proud Boys. So that's a remarkable accomplishment. So I think the Justice Department must be feeling good at the moment.
So I want to, again, check in on a question that we talked about in the context of the Oath Keepers, but To what extent does this case implicate anyone in the political echelon? I noticed that one of the two of these, the Proud Boy defendants, very specifically said they were operating on behalf of Donald Trump.
I wouldn't say that. No, the defense was that everybody was operating on behalf of Donald Trump. Yes, Trump caused the riot, and the riot was spontaneous, not a conspiracy. This would be the defense, and they were scapegoats. Yes, there were 200 Proud Boys present, but they responded essentially like the other 1,000 or 2,000 January 6th protester rioters, the way they did. And so they look at it and say, at 12:17 p.m., I think that's the first time, at least this was the evidence, Trump says, go to the Capitol, fight like hell, or you won't have a country anymore. And it's 36 minutes later that the barricades at the Peace Circle fall. And so they blame Trump for the riot, and everything was spontaneous. That's the defense.
But they didn't present any evidence that we didn't already know of Trump's conduct or anybody else's conduct on behalf of Trump, right? What you're describing is just a rhetorical posture or an argumentative posture. Did we learn anything about what Donald Trump did, about what anybody in operating on his behalf did?
No, that was not a part of the case. We heard the name Alex Jones a couple times, but it was glancing. It was trivial. No, we really did not. And that's true of the Oath Keepers case, too. This was not revealing as far as adding to the case against Donald Trump or anyone around him.
So it's fair to say that there really is, if not a hermetic seal or a wall, something of a barrier between the Trump case and the cases involving the political echelon at whatever stage of development they may be. And of course, Mike Pence was just in front of the grand jury. So we know those cases are proceeding, but they're really treating them as a separate matter with a separate group of prosecutors, and there's not a lot of admixture between the evidence in them.
I think that's right. And unless they're planning to charge incitement of insurrection, it seems like the charges, if charges are brought, are likely to be pretty different, with the possible exception of corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding. It sounds like they have different theories that they're pursuing.
So one other thing that we've talked about has been this question that is now in the appellate courts about the availability of certain charges in January 6th cases. To what extent is that charge at issue at all in here? It's not, of course, the seditious conspiracy charge, but there is a obstructing an official proceeding set of charges. Are any of these cases potentially vulnerable if the D.C. Circuit or the Supreme Court decides that the word corruptly, requires a pecuniary benefit?
Well, yes, there were 10 counts in this case that were either corrupt obstruction or conspiracy to corruptly obstruct. But the fact that they've obtained convictions in seditious conspiracy and also another conspiracy called conspiracy to prevent officers from discharging their duties, which is another sort of Civil War era statute. It's actually the criminal version of the Ku Klux Klan Act, or a criminal provision. That sort of lessens the danger here, because even if those charges don't survive, which is a long way off. I mean, I'm concerned about it, but really, it would be a ways off. And There's a good article that recently written by Randall Elias, and he thinks they're going to survive, but they're encountering some turbulence at the appellate level, those charges.
But in this case, though some charges could theoretically be affected or could be affected, they would not be the lead charge, except maybe in the case of Pezzola, right?
That's right. He was convicted of obstructing. He was also convicted of the third conspiracy charge, the Ku Klux Klan Act charge, but that has a maximum of 10 years as opposed to 20 years. And he was also convicted of some other felonies as well. So it won't be a catastrophe. There are, of course, at least 308 other January 6th defendants who have been charged with that, and more than 70 convicted. And some of them have been solely convicted of that, or that's the only felony. And obviously that would be a big deal.
Right. I mean, so it's fair to say that issue remains on the table. It will or could affect this case, but it won't affect this case catastrophically, though it could affect some other cases catastrophically from a large number from the government's point of view.
That's right. That's right.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest
people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. DeleteMe sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate DeleteMe, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
All right, we're going to go to audience questions in a moment. Before we do, though, so what is the big cases that are coming up now? It seems like this was the big one in the kind of pig in the python sense. Is there a Proud Boys 2 or an Oath Keepers 3? Are there big defendants waiting to be tried?
I don't think so. There's a 3%er case that's getting some attention, but I don't think it's really on this scale. It seems to be a sort of ragtag group. And these are the leaders. There are, I think, about maybe close to three dozen Proud Boys might have been charged with various crimes, but not all conspiracy. But those are smaller cases. So, no, I think the main arena now is Jack Smith. That is where our attention is wandering.
Yeah, so in a profound sense, you can say if Merrick Garland started this investigation by saying we work from the ground up, they did a whole lot of misdemeanors and low-grade felonies, and then they did a bunch of higher-grade felonies, and then they did the seditious conspiracy cases, and now they are looking at the people at the top of the totem pole. Although the Justice Department does say it may have as many of as 1,000 more cases to bring it at the street level, how seriously do you take that? We may have seen only half of the defendants in these January 6th street cases.
Well, it's possible. I did notice one number go down recently. For a long time, they had said that there were 350 people they were looking for on their bulletins. And I think they've recently adjusted that downward to say they're looking for 260 people, some very serious characters. And I shouldn't underestimate, these other cases. They're important cases. They're very violent attacks on police officers. 140 police officers were injured. Probably 20% of them have left the force. Many of them, it's hard to tell, the causes, but many of them obviously because of either physical or mental injuries. So those are terribly important cases. They just don't shed a lot of new light. We've seen the brutality in the tunnel archway on the Lower West Terrace, and there are more of those type of cases. Maybe I'll be surprised. And of course, we've still got, nobody ever got to the bottom of those two pipe bombs. But and actually, just this week, there was a new charge. Somebody was charged with throwing an explosive device at police officers in the Lower West Terrace. So there's some surprising things out there, but still, I think if you want to learn about what happened that day and why it happened, this, I think, might have been the most important case. The Oath Keepers, you know, it was a symbolic case, that image of all of them coming up the East Capitol steps in so-called stack formation in militia uniform. That was a powerful image, but they really had much less to do with what happened that day than the Proud Boys, who were really the tip of the spear at four crucial breaches that led to the invasion of the Capitol.
I just want to reemphasize that whenever we move as a group at Lawfare, we always move in stack formation. And, people don't believe it, but, you know, it's the most effective way to get a group from place to place. All right, let's go to audience questions. Shannon asks, I want to know if you think we may see charges for Roger Stone, Ali Alexander, or Alex Jones stemming from this case. If you do not, do you think there could be other charges brought against any of the three in relation to January 6th? So you said before that you heard Alex Jones's name mentioned a few times. These guys were kind of in contact with all kinds of people. What did we learn anything about Roger Stone, Ali Alexander, or Alex Jones?
In this case, there were just brief mentions of Alex Jones. The Proud Boys seemed to, at one point near, in their first pass past the peace circle, Ethan Nordine says something about, let's try to meet up with Alex Jones here, but that never happens. So we never learned more about that. Roger Stone, there were references to him in the Oath Keepers case. There was a contingent of Oath Keepers who were his security detail on January 5th and 6th. But unless Jack Smith has something, nothing I've seen implicates those guys. Same with Ali Alexander. I get the impression, Alex Jones was on what's called in a restricted zone. So you could charge him with a misdemeanor. They haven't. He's nominally a media guy, and he sort of seems to have hedged his bets in a way that would make it hard to prosecute him. He said some provocative things, but then he said some calming things. And he also left the premises when he saw things getting pretty wild. And his right-hand guy, Owen Schroyer, he was charged with a misdemeanor. But, unless Jack Smith has sort of something coming from a different direction, I'm not seeing yet how they would be charged with a true something relating to the insurrection itself.
All right. So Juliet asks, if the jury was having trouble understanding the remaining charges and instructions, did they get any further explanation before returning to continue deliberations? And if not, why not? So this is actually let me zoom that question out a little bit and say, when the jury came back, they came back with a partial verdict, not a complete verdict. They then reached additional verdict on at least one count. So, walk us through the events of the day vis-a-vis the jury.
Yeah, they passed out 10 notes, and the early ones were about just sort of gathering evidence. Can you tell us which exhibit number such and such a video was? And then there were some more substantive questions about the instructions, and they were good questions, I think. And then one had to do with this count 8 that they eventually rendered no verdicts on. And that was the water bottles. And what they noticed was at one part of the instructions, it says, you are not to speculate about why charges weren't brought against certain people that were, you may have heard their names mentioned. And then they said, well, how does that interact with this count eight, where the whole crime relates to something Charles Donahoe did, and he was never brought into court, and we don't know what happened to his case? And of course, I mean, spoiler alert, he pled guilty, but they don't know that. And so it was a good question. And originally, the judge wanted to tell them, you know, you shouldn't speculate about the charges against whether charges were brought against Donahoe or something to that effect. But the defense lawyers objected. And he ended up saying, I can't give you an answer. You know, just go back to the instructions. And they hung. So I think it was a sensible result. I don't know that they had lots of other questions that weren't answered. I think it was just an issue of proof and, you know, jurors in good faith disagreeing with one another. I was surprised they could get the consensus they did on all the crucial counts. There was a point, I think it was around the 13th and 14th, when one juror, when we were still hearing evidence, and one juror had some appointments, and the prosecution didn't want to take 2 days off. They wanted to get this over with, and there were still three alternates, so they wanted to say, let's dismiss this juror. All five of the defense lawyers said, no, 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 let's keep this juror. So I thought maybe they knew something we didn't, and maybe at some level they were right, you know, with some of these other counts, but it did not seem to get in the way of unanimous verdicts on all of the crucial counts.
There was one other oddity of the jury, which is that they were initially hung on Pezzola and then over the course of the day came to acquit him on the seditious conspiracy charge. How do you read that evolution?
Yeah, without interviewing them, I don't know. But as I said, that he was a different animal in a way. I mean, speaking metaphorically, he was in a different situation. He was a guy that had been involved for 2 months. You know, these other guys were president of their chapters or chairman of the national group. They were big deal Proud Boys. And so there was a reason to think that he was not a part of this conspiracy. And the difference between acquittal and hung
can be one vote.
Yeah. You know, so I don't know what happened there, but it seems fundamentally consistent with the fact that Pezzola was differently situated.
All right. So Dave asks, does the judge's relieving the jury of the need further to deliberate mean in effect that he didn't see a need to spend time on count seven, except for Pezzola, guilty, or count eight, as in we've got plenty already?
I don't think that's the way to look at it. Their last note, which I don't think has been published yet, but it will be, said something in very clear terms about further deliberation is not going to lead to a unanimous verdict. And by then they had been deliberating probably around 35 hours across 7 days. They had been listening to the case for 62 days. And I just think he thought, and I think basically all the lawyers thought, although some didn't want to go on the record saying it, that enough was enough. They'd done their duty. The gist of this was over. The government didn't need these additional feathers in their hat, really.
An anonymous listener asks, what were the reactions of the defendants and their attorneys and the prosecutors upon hearing the guilty and not guilty verdicts?
The defendants were very stoic. I did not see a reaction from Tario or Real. I couldn't get a good view of most of the others. Before the verdict, they were putting on a good face. They had the sort of stiff upper lip sort of thing. Tario had some smiles. He seemed to adjust Nordine's tie so he would look better. Defendant Zach Reel, to me, looked not very optimistic before the verdict. He seemed to have an inkling this was not going to go well.
Jill asks, any sense if it helped or hurt the two defendants who testified? Do you think not guilty on seditious conspiracy for Pizzola had anything to do with his testimony, or was it just that his circumstances were different from the others?
That's a good question. I mean, not to distinguish it from the others. That's a good question. They're all good questions. I think it may well have for Pizzola, may well have helped him. His direct testimony was very good. His cross, I thought, was very bad. So he began to lose his temper. He said that it was a corrupt trial and there were phony charges. And I thought the jury might respond negatively to that. But he was a good witness. And also his wife testified. She was a good witness. I actually read that testimony because I had to miss that day. But she... I'm told she was a good witness as well, and I think that may have helped. Zach Reel, on the other hand, I think it this is speculative. I think it hurt because he too was a little lower rung than the others, and he was not the top rung of the leadership of these chat groups that were focused on January 6th. And there wasn't as much about him or by him in the Telegram chats, but he took the stand. And then it turned out the government had found a video of him that looks for all the world like he's pepper spraying police officers. And he had said over and over and over that he never assaulted anybody. And after they showed him some of this footage, they said, now after seeing this and having thought about it overnight, did you pepper spray police officers? And he said, I don't recall. So his testimony was pretty bad. I think it hurt him, but Pizzola might well have helped.
Roger, if you had ever pepper sprayed a police officer, would you recall?
I think it's the kind of thing that I would recall personally. Yeah.
I there are a lot of things in my life that I forget, but the pepper spraying incidents tend to stick out in my mind. Kevin asks, why was Tario found guilty for the fence?
So this relates to destruction of property. There were two destruction of property counts, and one related to a metal fence that stretched across the West Plaza, and Nordine and Biggs, there was video of Nordine and Biggs apparently helping to tear this out of its anchors it was anchored into the concrete. They tore it out. This was called Breach 2. This enabled the rioters to surge forward. The police had to withdraw, and also the rioters then dismantled the fence and threw what I think you would call pickets, the metal bars that joined the top rail to the bottom rail. They threw those as weapons at the police officers. And why was Tario guilty of that in Baltimore? The same way that he was guilty of most of these things, because he was a conspirator. There is this concept called co-conspirator liability. And as with it was an unsuccessful theory with respect to the water bottles, and also with respect to the windows, the broken windows, why they made a distinction. I think possibly the fact that two defendants were intimately involved in the process, so it made it clearer that yes, this was in furtherance of the conspiracy. And yes, this was a reasonably foreseeable consequence of the conspiracy.
So Ruyi asks or states, would love to hear you guys talk more about seditious conspiracy. So rather than sit here and talk about seditious conspiracy, what I'm going to do is say that there is an enormous amount of material on Lawfare about the crime of seditious conspiracy, both historically and its use in a possible use and now successful use in January 6th cases. And these include some genuinely wild cases from the involving Puerto Rican nationalists in the 50s and 60s and 70s, as well as Christian nationalists, and of course the famous Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman case. So it's a very rich and interesting history involving both successful and unsuccessful prosecutions. And we've had a lot of arguments over the last few years about what the role of seditious conspiracy should be in these cases, because the language of the statute is actually exceptionally broad and doesn't actually require that any violence happen. But the Justice Department really uses it effectively as a domestic terrorism statute. And there's been some good writing, particularly by Alan Rosenstein, about how this basically is the American domestic terrorism statute, at least for terrorist acts directed at government. So, Roger, do you have additional general thoughts on seditious conspiracy?
No, I think that conveys it.
All right, we are going to wrap up. The final question is, the big question is Ben wearing a dog shirt? And of course, the answer to that question is yes. Dog shirts are daily. Roger Parloff, get some rest. It's been a lot of days. You're a great American, and a lot of people, including all of us, really appreciate your coverage of this trial. And we will be back soon.
Thanks very much, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. And today, you can't see this, guys, but it is also produced in cooperation with Anna Hickey, who is running the live feed, as well as the great Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo, who is producing an incredibly high quality recording of the two of us that's much better than you can hear out there in YouTube land. And look, y'all need to do your part to support the Lawfare Podcast. You should become a material of supporter of Lawfare if you are not one already. You can do that on Substack. You can do it at patreon.com/lawfare. And though material support for terrorism is a federal crime, material support for national security websites is not, so you will not be accused of seditious conspiracy if you do it domestically. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by the long-suffering Jen Patya Howell, who's going to have to take all this audio and make it into a podcast. Our music is, of course, performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.